Pack of Pushers are brought to you in part by INE, trusted training provider to the Fortune 500. Visit ine.com/packet to receive 15% off site-wide. This episode is sponsored in part by ThousandEyes, changing how you see the network. ThousandEyes shows you details of networks you don't own, such as the internet. Find out more at ThousandEyes.com/packet pushers.
Welcome to the Packet Pushers podcast, and today we are deep diving into the Network Functions Virtualization, or NFV. The words are synonymous and interchangeable. Virtualization of networking appliances has been around for quite some time. Those of you who can remember back far enough will know that we've actually been virtualizing networking gear since 2005, when some Cisco firewalls and other companies as well, but firewalls, Cisco's the one I knew at that time, you know, you were able to get a limited number of instances on a single hardware box, and that was shortly followed by the Cisco ACE load balancer, which could support like more than 10. It was quite exciting at the time. But subsequently, we saw the success of server virtualization, which meant that people started looking at network applications and thinking, why isn't that running in a VM too? Instead of running network applications on a mainframe type product where you buy everything single source from a single vendor on terms that they want to have, you know, you buy their hardware, their software, their applications, their support contract from their salespeople, and you can only buy what they want you to have. What if we could disaggregate that? What if we could break that open and start to say, you know, it would make more sense to have x86 servers with some software on top of them and then run my networking apps on top of that? Well, that's basically the idea behind NFV. And once you get your mindset into that thing, then a whole bunch of new solutions suddenly become possible. So joining us today to talk about Network Functions Virtualization is Jeff Doyle, who is, of course, to most of you, well known for the epic, truly epic textbooks that, you know, the whole entire series, Routing TCP/IP Volume 1 and Volume 2, which most of you would have more than a passing familiarization, probably hours. You know them too, don't you, Ethan?
Oh, yes. They're a standard reference. Everyone's read them or referenced them at the very least.
Mm-hmm. They're not quite exactly like your favorite fantasy novel, but I've certainly read them more than some books I've had in my lifetime. So welcome, Jeff Doyle, to the show. How are you?
I'm doing great, and thanks for all the kind words about the book. And yep. For a shameless plug, I just a few months ago released a second edition of Volume 2, which is mm-hmm. completely rewritten from the old book. So
mm-hmm. it's one of the definitive handlings of BGP, I think. I keep dipping into it to BGP to be disgusted at BGP, I must say.
Oh, yeah.
I knew that the second edition was out. I had started to reread it again. But you've also got some other books like OSPF and ISIS, Juniper Networks Routers, A Complete Reference, and a bunch of others. So if people want more about those, they'll be able to follow you. We'll talk more about those and have some links in the show notes. So let's kick on and start talking about NFV. Let's start off with why we want it. Let's talk about what it is that the business could get if we started to deploy NFV before we start deep diving on the technology.
Sure. And you know, I think you did a really good job of defining what NFV is, which is just virtualizing functions that that we normally see represented by some discrete device in the network, whether it's a switch or a router or you know, a firewall, a load balancer, some kind of a caching appliance, all the way up to things that would normally be represented by software, like a DNS server. You can virtualize, you know, and make that part of your NFV universe. But as far as business drivers, and there's a long list, but probably the number one business driver, most of the surveys that I've read around, you know, why do you want to deploy NFV, or what is your interest in NFV? The number one answer is always time to deployment. And this goes really to where NFV is primarily being driven, which is the service provider market. And service providers, of course, are notorious for order some kind of service, and it may take weeks or, you know, sometimes months to for that service to start.
Sometimes? Most of the time.
Yeah, exactly.
3 months is normally when, you know, even talking to people today, the sort of typical lead time on a carrier service of any sort is 12 weeks or 3 months.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so historically, That's where NFV is really coming from. I mean, it's been around, as you said, in data centers for a long time. If you talk about SDN vendors, you know, when you look at SDN controllers in the data center, they have NFV elements in them. You know, if you look at what NSX or ACI or Big Switch or Nuage or any of those, you can deploy switches and maybe some kind of firewall function and some kind of virtualized router with those things. And those are all really NFV. But where NFV is a separate trend is coming from is from telcos and service providers looking at what's happening in the data center and saying, you know, this is really important for us to expand our own networks. And so they started by going to Etsy. And for the life of me, I can't remember what Etsy stands for. European
Telephony Standards Institute.
Yeah. Thank you.
Standards Institute or something like that. It's French. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm terrible at remembering acronyms even when they're in English.
Why bother? Yeah.
But they started, there was just a few in the beginning, telcos and service providers that went to Etsy and said, let's build a framework for NFV so that we can begin, you know, very quickly, like data centers are doing, be able to orchestrate and quickly deploy virtualized services engineered for exactly what we need.
And, it's about the time. So if I can just, instead of buying a router or a box, an x86 box, every proxy server or intrusion detection system or firewall or router that's been released in the last 12 months is an x86 box already, right?
Yeah.
So the latest Cisco ISR 4000 platform is actually just an x86 server. They've put some special unicorn magic inside of it to make it look not much like an x86 server and kind of hide it away. But if you take the lid off, you'll see it's just an x86 server with an Intel motherboard inside. It's really just merchant silicon box all the way around. So the point is if you're going to run, now you said functions. I don't think in terms of functions. I think that's a quaint, old-fashioned carrier way of talking about applications. Because really what we have in a router or a firewall is a hardware, an operating system, and then an app that runs on top. And it's really about taking those apps, taking apart the hardware, the software, and the app, and putting the app in a VM. That's how I see it. And that's the function part.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. And, you know, I think the same way. I tend to always go back to routers as being being a router person forever, but you know, BGP is an app, OSPF is an app, and so in a network where you might now have to deploy some kind of pretty much if you deploy any physical router, you know, you've got this tightly integrated thing that has all kinds of applications in it that you'll probably never use. Whereas, you know, with NFV, you could say, well, I need a BGP instance at this point in my network. You know, over here, I need BGP and OSPF. Over here, I need network address translation. And, all of which are applications.
Mm. I think it's important to understand that, and that's a key part for the NFV. So certainly for carriers like AT&T with its Domain 2.0, which we've talked about a lot on previous shows and things, and they've been very adamant that they don't want to be stuck with vendor aggregated solutions. That is this mainframe model of hardware, software, hardware operating system application all from one place. They want to be able to take that apart and mix and match it. And that's just as important to their supply, to the way that they engage with vendors, as it is to the way that they operate the functions too, isn't it? Once you've got a function in software, all of a sudden you start thinking about, oh, well, if I don't have to think about the hardware and the operating system that it runs on, I can just focus on how do I drive the function? And then you put an API on it. And now my function is the center of this universe, not whether the box has got two Ethernet ports or four.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's also the fact that, you know, if you have a discrete box, you've got a discrete set of resources. You know, you've got a certain amount of CPU and a certain amount of memory. And if you want to upgrade that, you know, it may be if you need new features, so you have to upgrade the software. But you know, there comes a point where that box doesn't perform well in your network anymore, and you've got to completely replace it. So, if you're looking at the demands in your network, you're looking at some kind of I wish I had a whiteboard, but an undulating curve, that's rising and maybe falling, for resource demands in your network for CPU and memory and maybe bandwidth and all that kind of thing. And if you're trying to meet those changing demands by replacing boxes, you have this kind of stepwise not curve, just a more of a linear step that goes along and says at this point, this curve has exceeded my capacity, so now I'm underutilized, so I'm going to put this shiny new box in, and now I'm way overutilized until the curve catches up again, and now I'm underutilized again. Whereas with NFV, if you can orchestrate the resources for all of the functions in your network, as far as, now I need a little bit more CPU, I need a little bit more memory, I can start matching my resources with what that curve is doing. And I'm not having this wild fluctuation between, what I need and what I have.
You aren't limited by the box that because of it. And there's some interesting supply and demand issues there where the hardware that a networking vendor sells can be is often by the time they go through the development cycle is 4 or 5 years old.
And exactly.
Doesn't have this, a modern CPU or sufficient DRAM or doesn't have an SSD. Whereas x86 servers, they can spend 5 years developing the function, the app, and then just bang it onto the latest and greatest server, which you buy on the day that you need it. And so you get more bang for your buck than you do with the old hardware.
Exactly.
Yeah, but Jeff, I think there's a sales cycle inertia that particularly the enterprise struggles with, where they're just so used to the existing architectural model that they've got that changing from a great big box that does what they need until it doesn't anymore, and then they just buy an even bigger great big box so that it does now what they need. Hooray, and we didn't have to change much of anything except for the bigger box. Moving to NFV requires such a design and architecture change. It seems that folks are resistant to that. And this comes partly as I was just on the phone with someone before we started recording who was talking about exactly that. Their manager is so scared to go into any new world, any significant change in the way they do technology, that moving to something like NFV would be like, nope, we're just going to do the same thing, just bigger. Do you have a response for those that kind of thinking, I guess?
I think that's a challenge right now for the developers around NFV, whether they're commercial or open source developers, because I think there's a lot of truth to that. If I was running a small to medium-sized enterprise, I would be very wary of something like this too, because where the products are right now, you have to have somebody pretty sophisticated to be running these kinds of things. It's not like, you hire a CCIE and he can run all your Cisco boxes, or a JNCIE and he can run all your Juniper boxes, and maybe you need something, someone not even that highly certified. Whereas you start getting into NFV and, things around that, and this applies probably to SDN also right now, the technologies around that, like OpenStack, that really requires someone who has development skills and has programming skills and all of that. And that's a tough thing right now for small to medium enterprises to manage, to have that kind of skill set on staff, as opposed to just you got a box out there and you just configure it and you're good to go.
It's not just taking that box and moving it into running the virtual edition of it on your VMware platform in the context of what we're talking about. There's also this automation and orchestration aspect to the story.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I think as the virtualization industry in general matures, there's got to be a lot more orientation to fairly, if they want to move their business into smaller enterprise markets, there's got to be easy to use graphical interfaces and all that sort of thing. And NFV is certainly not there right now.
In the market today, where we're going to deploy NFV is going to go into a marketplace where we're seeing divergence between what service providers/carriers/telcos between what the enterprise is doing, and then also we start talking about the mega-scale data centers. So Amazon's, the Googles, and so forth, who've, you know, those companies have really aggressively pursued new ways of solving the, you know, the infrastructure problem. Like, all of this is an infrastructure problem. This isn't, you know, DevOps, although DevOps can use this. So if there's three markets, what makes them different? Are they actually different?
Yeah, I mean, the enterprise market is, you know, they're going to be looking for virtualization, and I'm kind of starting off with the market that I know the least about right now, but you know, they're going to be looking for things like self-service WANs. You know, like, can I start operating my WAN the same way I operate my cloud data, cloud-based data center right now? So basically, a cloud-based WAN. I can go in and you know, with some kind of a portal and order up new VPNs. You know, from point A to point B. I need these particular services on top of that VPN. You know, I need a router here. I need a firewall there. Load balancer, whatever. And so there's kind of that market. The data center market is certainly the most mature of all of them, because virtualization has been around for a long time, and the people working in the data center really understand it well. With SDN and the virtualized network functions that come with most SDN controllers, we're seeing finally the network being integrated into the same orchestration systems that are currently being used for storage and compute. For the telco, it's also kind of a new field. And it's something that, you know, obviously they're driving the NFV. There's interest in SDN, which is really managing the traffic flows in the network itself. But what they're looking at more is just being able to deploy those functions or applications virtually.
I think the important thing to think here is that when you deploy them virtually, you've got a big lever about being able to change them. So today, if I want to upgrade an appliance of some sort, you know, proxy server, an IDS, you know, that's doing inline work, it's very risky in the sense that if something goes wrong, the rollback is very hard. And this means that the failure modes are very brittle. So that is, if it fails, everything's dead. Something's gone horrendously wrong. And quite often, because we do HA, which is, again, a brittle failure mode, if I have one upgraded to the latest version, the other one probably can't work either. The best you can do is turn the standby off and upgrade the primary and hope that at some point in the time you can re-HA, you know, bring them back into a viable pair next week or something. With virtual functions, if you can implement them in a VM, you can actually just snapshot the VM, then do the upgrade. And if the upgrade fails because the vendor's software development is lousy, which happens all the time, let's face it, a lot of networking vendors are not very good at writing software, demonstrably so, right? Then you can just roll back to the snapshot and then you're back to where you were. I don't think people have thought, you know, they're not necessarily seeing the advantages of this new way all the time.
Yeah, and you know, something that's interesting, and it's sort of what you're saying about failure modes and HA made me think about something that's maybe not so much software oriented, but there's also the idea that if you're running all this on x86 and you have a hardware failure, you can recover very quickly from that. Something that data center operators have known for a long time. You know, if you have virtualized compute and a server fails, you can very quickly move your functions over to another server or move your workloads over to another server. But you can do that now in a service provider network too. If everything is x86 based on just servers and you have a server failure, you can very quickly roll out those same functions to another server and be back up and running.
So you think the enterprise, we've generally seen that the enterprise is going to be the last to change their business models. They don't seem to want, you know, they're either going to go to public cloud for now and say, let somebody else solve the network functions virtualization or use this, you know, automation and stuff, and let's just go there because it's too hard for us. Service providers are adopting it. I mean, we saw AT&T open source their eComp platform, the software platform that they built and use internally to do NFV and take that to the Linux Foundation. That was a week or so ago. Those are tectonic shifts in the way that things happen, because in the past they would have been operate NFV as a management system, you need something that's going to spawn the VMs, create the VMs, asset tag them, give you a list of what the, you can't just go and start doing them randomly using Vagrant to deploy them. You have to have an end-to-end lifecycle management system. And AT&T developed it and then put it in the open source for other carriers to use. I think that's a significant shift or a significant change in the way things work.
Absolutely. And I can't remember where I read the statistics. You guys may know it better than I do, but there's something like 35% of carriers and ISPs, planning some kind of NFE deployment. That statistic might be a couple of years old, but they're all looking at target dates of 2019, 2020 of having the majority of their systems supporting NFE.
And so this sort of leads us into the discussion about SDN, because NFE and SDN go hand in hand.
They do. Although you don't necessarily have to have SDN to have NFV, again, sort of, my service provider mentality maybe, but the real difference, I can't remember if I said it or if you said it earlier on, where SDN is really managing the flows through the network, NFV is managing the functions that operate on those flows. And so for service providers, and maybe that's the reason they started differentiating NFV from SDN, for service providers, a lot of them are saying, we want to be able to deploy these functions in our network. We want to be able to virtualize those, but we've already got the underlying infrastructure and we may or may not want to have SDN changing those flows.
Mm. So effectively, SDN is then the path creation between NFV instances, because once you're putting a function into a VM, it's not necessarily at a fixed pace in the network. So SDN is needed to map paths between two instances?
Yeah, you need SDN if you want to start. Well, you could be, depending on where you are in the network, you could be deploying a function right where you need in the flow, but usually you're going to have service chaining where you say, this flow has to go through a router to make certain decisions, has to go through a firewall, has to go through a load balancer, and in a certain sequence. So you might be using SDN, or again, if you're a service provider, you might be using some other kind of traffic engineering mechanisms to set up that service chain. To sequentially service a flow.
You have a take on service chaining, Jeff, as if, that technology's got 15 different ways you can do it. None of them are the same. Some form of tunneling seems to be the general consensus these days, particularly if you're going from hypervisor to hypervisor. We don't hear much about NSH these days. At least I haven't heard much about it since it, some guys within Cisco were pretty excited about it and so on, which kind of makes sense. If we're going to get big adoption of NSH, you're going to need silicon spun up to deal with that header. That I liked what NSH was bringing to the table, though. Is there a standard way that we're going to end up with to do service chaining?
Oh man, it is just me making the prediction. I think we're going to see tunneling, some sort of expanding tunneling. To really mean VPNs of some sort. I think that's what we're going to see for a long time, because that's what's easy to build.
It works with what we
and
got.
Well understood. Yeah. And longer term, I have no idea. But it seems to me like VPNs is something that's proven and well understood.
Which then goes back to the to SDN, because we wouldn't be standing up a bunch of tunnels to make service chaining work. You got to have that automated component, that SDN that can see this traffic's got to traverse this path because of this policy, and therefore I'm going to construct this hop by hop to make that go.
Yep.
Does that go back to the expertise thing, though? I mean, if that's the model that we're moving towards, does the requirement for expertise mean that at some point there's going to be a network that has those people on staff, and so therefore they run all this fancy stuff, and smaller, medium-sized businesses, they don't just because they don't. You know, they just don't. They can't develop the talent in-house to make those sorts of solutions go. It's too complicated. It's too hard, and possibly too fragile.
Right, but in reality, is that really all that different from what we've got right now? You know, I mean, a service provider network or a physical data center network as opposed to, you know, a cloud-based data center. You know, you have people there that are deeply knowledgeable about that network and about the protocols that are running in that network and the devices that are running in that network. And with enterprise networks right now, their staff is maybe not all that knowledgeable, and they lean a lot more heavily on their vendors. But they, you know, they really, the network itself maybe is not that complex unless you're talking about a large enterprise. And so you need relatively less sophistication in your staff to be able to sufficiently operate that network.
Well, for those environments, do we just, in a certain sense, engineer the complexity out by moving them into converged or hyper-converged infrastructure where a lot of the details, it is just as complex, but it's just hidden away behind shiny GUIs and so on that make it more of a push-button kind of scenario?
Yeah, exactly, and that's what I was saying early on is that's really going to be up to the vendors, you know, and enterprise networks. I think the vendors more than open source solutions are going to continue to own that market for a long time, for exactly that reason, because they're the ones that can roll out products that on the surface are pretty simple to operate. And so, you know, to orchestrate your enterprise network, you know, you're doing a lot of pointing and clicking and you know, GUI-based operations.
Yeah. And this comes back to this. Today, you'll need, if you wanted to get involved with this, you'll need some programming skills. You'll need to have a very strong awareness, in my view, of applications and OpenStack and virtualization and storage. But I believe as time goes by, you'll see a lot of that just get hidden behind platforms, you know, the vendors are going to produce us cloud orchestration systems, and a lot of what happens in behind there, all the levers and the gears and everything, you won't need to know them. In the same way that a lot of people don't know, so if you think you know OSPF today, you know a little bit about OSPF, but you don't actually know how a database search is performed to find a route, or a bubble sort, or whether it's using, you know, a tree sort to find the best route out, or you don't understand that the caching algorithms are using this algorithm. All you know is that there's a cache and that it does, and this is effectively a good enough model to know how it operates. I think eventually that we'll see that come into the enterprise where there are tools that simplify those functions for us.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, OSPF is the perfect example there. You know, there can be a lot of, well, OSPF itself, you know, you read the standards and you get a pretty good idea of how it works and all that. But in the background, for a good OSPF implementation, there are all kinds of deep tweaks to make it perform correctly and scale correctly and work securely and all of that. And the vast majority of people that deal with OSPF don't need to know all those things, you know, especially if you're in an enterprise. Well, really, if you're in a service provider network, you know, you set up the things and you turn the knobs you need to turn and specify the features you need within your OSPF instance, and it just works. And if it doesn't work, then you call your vendor.
Well, it's just, I mean, yes, that is the default point where you end up. It just made me reflect on, I wish calling your vendor meant you were going to have a quick and capable solution to the problem. But so rarely does that seem to be the case these days.
Yeah, that's true. You know, that also goes back to something you were saying early on about who you're talking to, you know, that just wants to stick with, you know, the traditional way of building and operating their network. And it's because you know, you cling to the idea of you know, I can operate it up to a certain point, but then if things break, I need to know that I can call someone that can apply the right expertise to, you know, whether it's a bug fix or whatever, to get my network up and happy again. You know, I don't have to hire some guy that is mostly not going to be used, you know, to dive into the code of my OSPF implementation or my, you know, again, NFV implementation or whatever.
Before we get back to the show, Ethan is here letting you know that our sponsor, INE, has an all-access pass subscription to their extensive training library. It's $9.99 per year for every course in their collection, and that is over 330 networking-specific courses that go from automation using Python to full-blown Cisco CCIE tracks. There's over 8,500 videos in their collection. Now, INE's training style, it's for those people who like to learn by doing, so don't die by PowerPoint. Instead, watch the hands-on demonstrations that make up about 70% of INE's content that show you exactly how to do what it is that you're learning about. And by the way, there is lots to learn from trainers that are among the most knowledgeable and certified in the business. They'll teach you Wireshark, software-defined networking, and Juniper, along with, of course, the many different Cisco certifications, including the prestigious CCIE. If we go back in time to 2007-2008, INE was one of the training providers that I used to help me pass the Cisco CCIE Routing and Switching Lab. You can learn from anywhere using your smartphone, tablet, PC, or Apple TV, and you can even rent a remote rack of equipment, gaining you access to gear that's too expensive to acquire or too difficult to virtualize. And if you're a little overwhelmed and you're just not sure what courses are the right ones for you, you can talk to an INE training advisor who will help you prepare a study path. Head over to INE.com/packet to start exploring what INE has to offer and receive 15% off your purchase site-wide. One more time, that's INE.com/packet. Jeff, I want to get your take on silicon within NFV. So x86, sure, that's the obvious place that we start and what everybody talks about. But there are some switch manufacturers and other silicon makers that are making silicon customized for NFV to accelerate it. There are NIC vendors like Netronome that will hook into OVS or Contrail and then accelerate the packet traffic that is flowing through those virtual switches. So are we going to see? I mean, the latest grouping of the people that left Cisco there, I just spacing out the name of their company, Penda Sutton or another. Anyway,
Sando.
Yes, they're
the people who were the progenitors of ACI
are making another ASIC. They're going to do something amazing. The rumors have it with silicon for networking and for storage. So, does the need for special and magical ASICs ever go away?
It goes away in some aspects. I don't think it's ever going to completely go away because there's always going to be parts of your network and there's always some tipping point, you know, just running functions on an x86 box and trying to scale that up by just saying, well, I'll just, you know, if my load increases, I'll just keep deploying more of this function across my network. It just doesn't. I'm sort of conflicting my terms here, but that trying to scale at some point doesn't scale, and you've got to you've got to start having hardware, that can correctly manage the or correctly perform at the loads you need, and really NFV down at the hardware level, down at the NFV infrastructure, you can still be deploying, dedicated boxes and dedicated switches. I think it's more the brains above that that can continue for a longer time, being scalable with a lot less resource demand.
Yeah, so, right. So we're differentiating a couple of things there. One is, yes, there are certain functions we're just going to move on to x86, and that's fine, because if you looked at the appliances you were buying anyway, I think, Greg, you made this point earlier in the show, and you peel the cover back, oh, look, it's an Intel box. It's nothing that special anyway.
So one of the things I put into the show notes was that we're seeing the rise of NICs, so really smart network NICs that are able to do an awful lot of packet processing. So the things that we used to rely on ASICs to do, are increasingly becoming things that can be handled in a NIC that has some, you know, really nice high performance silicon in there. And this idea of a coprocessor has become increasingly very powerful, I think. And we underestimate the capabilities of this silicon, or people underestimate the power of silicon to their peril, in the sense that the things that make it, you know, viable are often, you know, like the event. Now we know that Moore's law is finishing and so forth, and the complexity of developing software is incredibly difficult as we, as things go forward. But increasingly, the capability of different types of ASICs that are absolutely determined mean that ASICs are, you know, silicon is still going to be working for us, I think, for the time being. Yeah.
What all this makes me think of is again SDN in the data center, especially if you look at vendors like Big Switch or Pika 8 or the ones that are really pushing bare metal or white box solutions. And I think that's also what NFV starts giving you. You really just have the separation of, you know, the applications that are running on top of this virtualized hardware, but the hardware still has to be there. But you know, somewhere in the future, perhaps, you know, it depends on how much the big vendor is really going to handle on all this. But you could be running, you know, just saying, I'm just going to buy a forwarding plane that I deploy into my SDN and NFV enabled network, that, you know, I load the software I want onto it, and I'm no longer having to buy an integrated control plane along with my forwarding plane.
I was looking at a company the other day, and they literally make a specialist networking box that's an x86 server with an FPGA. It has all the ports and all the, you know, the failover, you know, the automatic failover between Ethernet fail shut, so it'll, you can just goes in line. You can buy that box by the thousands units, and it's all pre-made, and they'll do it, and then you can go and work with them to define what color you want on the outside and what face place you want. All you really need to do is develop the software to load into the FPGA and then get a Linux operating system, and boom, you've built an appliance. So I think things are really, really changing.
Yeah, and right now, and I know that you know, you've had people like Rob Sherwood from Big Switch on before that have probably said these kind of things. But right now, if you go buy a generic bare metal switch, you're probably buying the same switches from the same manufacturers, probably in Taiwan, that your big name vendors are using and selling to you, just without the faceplate.
Jeff, I want to follow up on something really important here that you said, which was this is partly going to depend on whether or not the large vendors can kind of get it together to deliver to us this sort of we've been talking about disaggregation. We've been talking about the disaggregated network model here, and yet it is, by and large, outside the large vendors' interests to have a disaggregated model. Certain of their customers, their very large customers, are forcing them to offer certain products in that space, but they haven't, the big vendors have not said, yes, you guys at the hyperscale data centers that buy from us want this, and so we'll do it, and it's good for you, and it's good for everybody, by golly, and so we're going to push this change, you know, throughout the enterprise. They don't see it as an opportunity. They see it as a threat. And there's been a lot of defensive moves to keep that vertically integrated stack together and keep selling that, which has caused in part, a lot of this fragmentation we see in various network architectures that are out there now. And I think is also part of the confusion that current network practitioners have, particularly young ones, as they hear about all this new stuff and go, I don't know what direction to go. You know, I don't know what direction to head. You know, NFV and is one thing, and disaggregation is a thing, and automation is a thing, and but none of it's my world. You know, my world is a Cisco CLI, because that's the large vendor I deal with and how I manage things. Is, you know, what is the destiny of the large vendors here?
I think it's going to be do or die. I mean, they're always going to have, you know, as I've sort of been saying all along here, they're always going to have, in my opinion, I shouldn't say always, but, you know, 10 years out or so, there's still going to be a market in small and medium enterprises where, you know, there's not the sophistication or really even the need to do anything beyond, you know, just operating their network through the CLI or, you know, through whatever GUI comes with the box. But where they're really going to be threatened, as you pointed out, is where the customer's staff has a lot more sophistication. You know, so in the larger data centers, in service provider and telco networks, you know, that's not always the case, but usually the case. You know, they have people on staff and can afford people on staff that are not as threatened by these new technologies. And
so, I guess that's part of DevOps. That whole DevOps movement starts to make it possible for technology to departments like the information technology teams are able to take control of their destiny again and not have to keep outsourcing expertise or knowledge or vision or strategy to IT companies, which is what's been happening for the last 20 years. It was a trend that started in the late 90s when technology was really hard and it made sense to, you know, we'll go into IBM and get them to help us with our technology because we couldn't possibly. And that was true, but that's no longer true. As the technology disaggregation goes through and the components break apart, it's much easier to work on one piece at a time. As components commoditize and the cost of things reduce, it's much more effective to transfer your spending away from expensive assets to cheaper assets and have people on board who can operate them. So instead of having the metaphor that I've been using lately for this is, we want our IT departments to look much more like a Formula One racing car. That is, you've got a team of people who are there to make the car go much faster than it used to be, instead of like a normal family sedan where the family sedan goes to the garage to be fixed once every 6 months, fingers crossed, right? It's much more going to be businesses need to operate at Formula One speed. So to do that, they have to have a design team and an operational team that can make changes while the race is in progress, change tires, fuel, and all that sort of stuff. And that's the transition, I think, at a business level that's happening.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, something that's really important out of what you said there is the whole trend something that out of what you said is important. That sounded like the rest of it wasn't important, but it didn't mean it that way.
It wasn't important. If it came out of my mouth, it's really not important.
But something I guess I keyed on is the whole trend around DevOps. And this is entirely my opinion. You know, if you look at sort of, and it really doesn't have so much to do with NFV, it's really around network virtualization trends in the data center. You know, sort of the 1,000-pound gorillas right now are NSX and ACI, and they have two very different orientations, you know, just because of who's operating it. So you know, Cisco ACI is really a very infrastructure oriented and will adapt the infrastructure to applications and so forth. Whereas NSX is because that's coming out of VMware, is more, you know, no, we want to start pulling the network virtualization into, you know, the exact same orchestration that we've got for storage and compute. And that's all being driven by DevOps. And I think that for that reason, VMware is at least in the data center, is a really big threat to Cisco. And I think because of the DevOps trend, you know, I think that is
the ACI product
challenge.
Seems to match better with a historical model or yesterday's model of IT. And NSX is much more about where the puck is going to. That's not to say that ACI can't transform, but it does seem to not be have momentum in the direction that it should be going. I think also the here is public cloud, right? The thing about NFV is that it's public cloud ready. Virtual functions on VMs in the public cloud, sure, you can do that. You can do that in a private cloud data center or public data center, someone else's computers, just as much. So it's, to me, it's very much the future of computing, because at least for the next 10 to 20 years, I think public cloud is going to be, you know, a substantial, not all of it, but a substantial part.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we forget that kind of stuff. Let's talk a little bit about standards bodies. I think one of the things about NFV is that we do need to have interoperation. So most of the standards that we have today for NFV are sort of like x86, you know, memory storage and Ethernet interfaces, or even virtual NIC interfaces in virtual machines. But are there other standards bodies? If we're going to orchestrate, you know, 100 firewalls or 1,000 virtual instances spread across your estate, you know, in the case of enterprise, it's going to be WAN routers plus firewalls plus load balancers plus, and security engines are particularly going to be critical. Are there standards bodies that are getting together to provide tools? And what sort of standards are they producing?
We mentioned Etsy early on. I mean, that's where NFV had its beginnings. And they're building the basic NFV framework, you know, for NFV, you know, differentiating a framework that has NFV infrastructure, which is both the physical and the virtualized compute storage and network. You know, there's a separate component that sort of contains all of the virtual network functions. And then the really key piece of that, tying it all together, is management and orchestration part. And that's all being standardized by Etsy. So you know, everybody calls it Mano, but management and orchestration that has different within the Mano part of the framework, there's different structures. You know, there's a virtual infrastructure manager that's managing all of those physical and virtualized infrastructure parts. There's a VNF manager, and then there's an orchestrator inside of it that's sort of not only tying those things together, but also tying into more traditional or existing business functions. You know, the billing and billing functions and all that sort of thing, you know, that needs to be tied into the orchestrator. And they're also defining the reference points within the architecture. And that's the really key piece that is, you know, saying, okay, the VNF manager can speak to all of these different vendors' VNFs as long as they comply to this particular reference point, you know, which is probably going to be some kind of RESTful API. Oh, and the other thing I should say about Etsy, if you look on their webpage, there's a lot of proofs of concepts papers on there that you know, especially for service providers, are a really good place to start.
Do you think so? A lot of these forums were all based in a time when, you know, they used to work on 5-year, 10-year intervals of change, and you know, like the IEEE continues to futz around with the Ethernet standard, like. We saw Andy Bekelstein, who is, you know, one of the co-founders of Arista, stand up and say, that's great, you've done 100 gig, that's all done, that's great, where's 400 gig? And they're going like, oh, well, we aren't planning to start that for another 3 years. And he's going, but we need it now. You know, the Metro Ethernet Forum doesn't believe that IP packets exist. They're still only building layer two. I've been there. I've been to their meetings and talked to their executive, and as far as they're concerned, IP is not a part of their strategy in any way, shape, or form. So the idea of them building APIs for IP-based services just seems hysterically funny to me.
Which is interesting, and maybe that is because I was actually going to say, you know, as far as standardization forums go, another one that is important is the Metro Ethernet Forum. I'm glad you started off by saying those things because. Yeah. I guess there, obviously, because it's Metro Ethernet, you know, they're going to be what they believe in as layer two, you know, but they are playing a big role right now in
Well, they have to because they'll be dead if they don't, right?
Yeah, so, yeah. They've got the whole third network initiative and all of that.
But I mean, they're only doing it because they know that if they don't, that organization will die. I know any good bureaucracy dies, you know, when it's threatened with survival, it'll actually do something. But I'm not 100% sure that the MEF, you know, an organization that only focuses on end-to-end paths is now all of a sudden defining software and APIs. That doesn't make sense to me. And, you know, where do they get the skills and the capabilities to develop processes and standards? And whose voices do they speak with? Or who do they speak on behalf of is the one I can't understand. And the TM Forum, obviously the TM Forum is a very interesting historical platform where there is a lot of very, let's just say the people who run that forum and the ownership of the profits that forum generates is not actually a not-for-profit, it is a for-profit organization. And again, it exists because historically it did something 20, 30 years ago that was valuable and they got into a time when closed source was the natural way. But again, are they relevant in the future? The work that I've seen from theirs looks very like, well, duh, that's obvious. It doesn't look like it's innovative or capable to me.
I don't think so. And you know, I need to caveat that by saying I don't follow the TM forum very much. But you know, you see them listed, you know, anytime there's a list of, you know, NFV standards bodies, TM forum is always somewhere on there. But I don't really see them doing much you know, innovative or relevant work. There's another one, Addis, that I actually, I don't think I've ever even looked at their website, so not sure what's happening there. IETF.
Anytime a new market appears, there are people out there who are going to, you know, do this. They're going to try and enter the market and take control of it. So that's not a surprise.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm.
What were you going to say about the IETF, Jeff?
Oh, I don't see them doing that much around NFE right now. I mean, they have some working groups. They have the service function chaining working group, that sort of thing. That and that might just be because I haven't looked at the right working groups, but I haven't seen them do much around NFE either.
No, that's true. I think we're going to see much more come out of this around open source. There'll be open source people that produce something and then it'll be used. Like a lot today we have OpenStack APIs are very common because they exist and there's already tools and libraries available for them. And a lot of the OpenStack APIs are relevant to NFE, I think. You know, create a VM. Yeah. Okay, why would I invent one? Why don't I just use the OpenStack one?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, if you look at NFE deployments that are out now or, you know, that are being experimented with or whatever, it almost always involves OpenStack.
Still? And I say that in the sense that OpenStack of late seems to be falling from popularity, difficult to implement for a lot of folks, requiring a lot of expertise, and then a bit of a moving target, and some folks have moved on to other orchestrators, Kubernetes being, everyone's all excited about that one now, and a lot of projects are based on Kubernetes and so on. Not that those are exactly the same tool, they're not, but still, the shine seems to have come off of OpenStack a bit, and so I've been wondering if it's entering the phase of the people that are running OpenStack are going to keep running OpenStack. They've got it working and they're going to just kind of soldier on, but there's not going to be too many greenfield or new adoptions of OpenStack. That's speculation on my part, but curious what your thoughts were.
I think that there are enough vendors behind OpenStack and which is really key for any kind of open development forum is having the right vendors and customers, or users behind it to keep development going. And I sort of see OpenStack as still maturing more and more and continuing to grow and becoming as you start seeing commercial interests growing up around OpenStack. Mirantis is the one I keep thinking of here. That sort of starts simplifying things, to where it's not just a developer's playground anymore, but it starts becoming something that's a lot more simple to deploy and into networks. You know, that I think that has to happen with OpenStack, but for it to continue. But I think it will continue. Just my opinion.
I mean, fair enough. It's got enough, as you said, enough momentum behind it and vendors that are invested in it that, no, it doesn't seem like it's going to die tomorrow. And I'm not hearing stories of abandonment exactly. You do hear, I mean, there's HP's Helium Public Cloud Service, which was, as I understand it, based on OpenStack, went away. And some of the scuttlebutt was, well, frankly, OpenStack was too hard to make work and we didn't get enough customers to overcome the difficulty of making the solution work, so we're just gonna pack it in. Other things you hear about that, but fair enough. It's just it's funny how certain products and projects become media darlings, and there's a lot of hype and all this momentum around them, and then all of a sudden they seem to go dark. No one's talking about them. There's not a lot of, and you just wonder what happened. And OpenStack is definitely on that list.
I think OpenStack might be moving through its trough of disillusionment. People have gone, oh, we can make this work. We can, and then all of a sudden, like, actually, it's a bit harder than we thought. and like you said, there's a lot of vendor engagement. And I think, as I've said before in other shows, the momentum might have moved out of the enterprise space, which was a smaller problem space, into the telco space, whose need for a platform which is free, like the basic functions are common, shared, standardized to some level, and they can deploy OpenStack without having to build, to continually pay license fees for what is you know, basically a function that everybody should have. You know, it's a bit like having a butthole. Everybody's got one. You shouldn't have to pay to have a butthole, right? And that's really what OpenStack is. And it's going to be...
Okay, that might have just become my favorite analogy.
Did you see how polite I was there? I'm in a splendid mood today. And I think that's a critical thing. I don't think that carriers, you know, who will have... If you think of every carrier exchange as a mini data center, and you're going to put an orchestration tool in there, like some software-defined data center tool, and turn that into a pool of VMs, if you're going to spend $500,000 or $1 million licensing that every year, and that's what the current vendors want to charge you is $1 million a year for an SDDC deployment. Well, if you've got 10,000 of those, well, that's suddenly like $1 billion in licensing before you actually start to make revenue out of it. And your service fees, right? You're still going to pay maintenance on top of that. That's not going to scale. That's not the functions that you want. You have to have something that is open source, really, so that everybody can glom onto that and say, well, we're all going to use the same platform. We get standards. It meets our cost goals, and we can innovate on top of that. We don't want to innovate in that. We want to innovate over the top of that. And that, I think, is where NFV, again, coming back to the value of NFV, where if you can put a firewall in a VM, now all of a sudden I can move the VM around, I can upgrade it, I can stun it, I can configure it with software because I've got this, the VM is now in a container, a conceptual container where I can API it and configure it, I can turn it off, I can turn it on. I don't have to run downstairs to power it off to actually get a genuine power off, right? Like you do with some devices. You know, all these things change, and now all of a sudden if the VM can move around in the infrastructure, well, now I've got the ability to do some weird things. I could start to use SDN to chain the virtual functions together. Well, what if I could create 10 of them and share load between all 10? Like we recorded a podcast 2 weeks ago in February with RV Networks, and they have a virtual load balancing function. What they mean is it starts up in an x86 and it runs, and when it reaches an automatic, when you just say, you know, when it reaches 80% of load, spawn another instance. And then it dynamically shares the load between the two instances. You don't even know that another instance has been created. That's sort of the direction that we're going to go in, I think. And it's, you know, you want to pay for the load balancing features, but you don't want to pay for the software-defined data center functions that sit underneath it because they don't make you money. They're just overhead.
This is becomes wildly speculative, I guess, but something that I've thought about for years, and it starts tying in artificial intelligence and machine learning and all these kinds of things, starting to bring those into networks is you know, at what point does the network become far less managed and touched on a day-to-day basis by network operations? And is instead just looking at what applications are being deployed and automatically adapting to those applications. Maybe I'm asking that as a question to you guys, that because you see so much of where the industry is going. Do you see us going that way?
I definitely do, but I think it's not going to come from the enterprise. Like in the past, changes come from the small enterprise. And they would do small things, and they would buy these things, and then it would scale up. My vision of this is that we're already seeing NFV coming from companies like Amazon and Facebook, because that's exactly what they do. And they have a zero operations function. So none of the deployment of routing or switching or firewalls or, you know, monitoring and telemetry, that is all automated in a system that they write and develop. And they have a team of, you know, 10, 20, like Facebook, for example, has a team of 10 to 20 people working full time on the network, but they're not configuring it. They're writing features into the network. So they're working on software that does BGP. They're working through, you know, that uses BGP as an SDN technology, or they're working on, you know, an operating system for switches so they can throw out 90% of the software that's in the vendor switches, because that stuff's just unreliable on mass, you know. I think that's the model that we're going to go down, is eventually there'll be orchestration systems that do all these things, and you spend your time designing them. So at a recent Tech Field Day event, I saw the Riverbed demo and I saw a Silver Peak demo of their SD-WAN platforms, and you were able to literally go into the graphical consoles, and just for clarity, I've seen this also on Viptela and a bunch of others, right? You go into the graphical console, You click, 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 and you say, I'm going to add a new device in Boston, and here's the serial number of the device. When the device powers on, it reaches out over the internet and then gets it automatically configured by the platform. And then if you want to add a new access control list into the box, you don't tell Net to 30 routers and start adding ACLs to them. You go into the console and say, I want all the people in this Active Directory group to be able to access Microsoft Azure. Click, 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 bang, deploy, all done. Those things are here now. They're just not evenly distributed, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah.
Thousand Eyes, our sponsor today, says that they change how you see the network. And as someone who's spent many hours with their product, that's not just a tedious marketing claim from yet another monitoring company. Rather, Thousand Eyes gives you insight into the parts of the network that you don't own, but that your critical services run across anyway. Imagine being able to monitor in detail the internet between you and your customers or between you and your SaaS providers. With Thousand Eyes, you can do exactly that. You will be able to see every individual router between you and the target you're monitoring, along with a historical view of the BGP state, alternate paths, as well as latency and loss metrics all across the internet, that network you do not own. The monitoring tests are run via Thousand Eyes cloud agents, enterprise agents that you place at useful spots in your infrastructure or on endpoints like laptops. So you can get a true end-to-end graph of a path no matter where it starts and ends, inside your network or outside of your network. You can go up the stack as well. Do things like track CDN performance, look at DDoS attack and analyze it. Check out DNS server errors. Look at issues within your ISP's network using internet outage detection, which is a really cool Thousand Eyes feature. You can measure mean opinion scores for VoIP paths and do in-depth web transaction monitoring to find out why that web server really is slow. And all these features are available through an intuitive interface that you drill into to get right to the root cause of the problem. When the root cause is spotted, you can then create a shareable report, which is really handy when you want to share what you found with that upstream third party that you might not have a business relationship with. If you are interested in Thousand Eyes, you can check them out at thousandeyes.com/packetpushers. Sign up there for a free trial and a free t-shirt.
Well, Jeff, I want to get some nuance on your question, though, because the way I heard it, you correct me if I'm wrong, you asked something along the lines of, is the application going to be able to ask for more resources or something along those lines?
Yeah, and, and I mean, totally speculative on my part. I've sort of jokingly referred in the past to, moving from software-defined networks to application-defined networks, where the application does just, interact directly with the network and say, I have these specific needs and these specific constraints, whether that's, performance or security, well, probably all those things. And so I'm going to directly talk to the network, and just say, oblige me.
Yeah. Express intent. So let me take a little different tact than Greg. I think we have a communications problem. In other words, right now there is no standardized way for an application to make such a desire known to say, I need X. There's neither a set of protocols that could be used for that, nor is there a standard language that an application could describe exactly what it's looking for. And we're making headway with intent, with network intent, but those are still all seem to be scattered approaches. And there's a lot of discussion about how do you take intent and then how detailed of a way do you... how far down do you have to go to actually accomplish what needs to be accomplished? And then you get into vendor differences, and it becomes increasingly challenging to, in a predictable way, take that intent and turn it into what that specific vendor app needs. Now, you add to that the complexity of everyone's network being a little bit different. So everybody's a snowflake, because we are. And that makes it even harder. And so this is interesting to me because it comes back around to an idea I keep, as I think through a lot of these problems, keep coming back to in my brain, which is, well, if we'd start bloody well building networks the same, at least as much as we could, in a more modular and predictable way, according to a framework that was generally agreed upon as an industry, and we were trained as engineers and architects to build this way, unless we needed to depart, it just becomes very hard to say this is what I need. I need more of X, whatever X is, whether it's networking or you know, some different part of the stack, storage, compute, et cetera. It's just incredibly hard. It's an incredibly difficult problem. And so you look at an intent-based startup like Apstra, for example, and in their tool, you can build a specific network that's multi-vendor, and as long as you're running their Apstra operating system as the shim, if you will, between that network hardware and their intent engine, you can build a network that conforms to your specifications. You don't have to get under the hood, worry about configuration stanzas and these sorts of things. They've taken care of that. But the key is, and how it works, or why it works as well as it does, is that you're building a very specific thing. It's formulaic. You can build a leaf spine network. You can build, I forget all that they've advanced since the 1.0 product, and you can build more stuff now. But it was very rigidly defined what it was that you could build. I mean, there was some flexibility within that rigid definition. But if you're trying to take that sort of an idea and retrofit it to your existing network, it's hard. And I think, but that is, in fact, what we need to do to have a framework that an application could express its needs and desires to the network. You got to have it talk to a controller of some kind, that controller to take those desires and push them down in specifics into the network. And with all of the variety we have amongst vendors and the way we've built our networks, vendor issues aside, I don't know how we get there, honestly. I think we got to go through a real serious a look at architecture and design from a standardized way that is something vendors wouldn't want us to do because it takes away their differentiation and so on. So a long way to answer the question, but it's something that's been on my mind a lot.
Yeah, that's the real speculative part for me is, you know, obviously there has to be some sort of common language that doesn't exist right now. You know, if you're just going to be able to say, I can put any vendor's gear into my network, and maybe that's not the right approach there either. You know, maybe it always has to be, well, certain vendors in my network, you know, but then, you know, and that's why I brought up the whole idea of artificial intelligence is, you know, where would that even reside? Is that, does that mean an intelligent network, which kind of runs adverse to everything we've been talking about so far, but, you know, do we have an intelligent network that that knows what applications are suddenly appearing and just adapts and, you know, understands what that application needs and you know, so it automatically deploys the functions that are necessary for that application. And you know,
I think maybe that's the closest we're going to get. Yeah. Something like Kubernetes that'll do, it'll scale out. It doesn't know much about the app, but it can tell when a certain host is being overutilized and we got to spread the load out and so we can spin up more containers with that particular application in it and move it around or just, you know, add capacity to that application so it continue functioning as it needs to. But even it's, as the Kubernetes folks have told me, is at the moment still a little crude in its capabilities. It's not very fine-tuned as to the sorts of things you can key off of, but is getting better. And that, you know, but that is still not talking to the application. That is making inferences about the application based on what load is presented to the hardware and then going, I guess we found a bottleneck. Let's move the bottleneck, sort of a game, rather than an intelligent, I'm talking to the app, it's telling me what it needs, and I'm going to, you know, build this out sort of problem. And that was just one example. I mean, that's a little different from getting into exactly what the network topology should look like and so on and so on. Although those pieces are there too, if you've templated them out ahead of time. This app needs to talk to these other apps and we want it to look like X of the six templates that you've got that I could possibly choose from, which again, isn't asking for what it needs. It's you've got these things to choose from and then standing it up in a templated way so you can automate it, even if there's not really any intelligence behind it as such.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I mean, looking at what's necessary right now to deploy, you know, certain apps, you know, if you look at voice, you know, there's generally a lot of, you know, fairly complex QoS design work that has to be done around a network that's going to support voice or support real-time video and all of that. And, you know, and how do you put voice and real-time video at the same time on the same network? And, you know, how do you design your queues and how do you plan for capacity around all of that? And, you know, how do you correctly mark the packets in that kind of a network? You know, as opposed to just having the network say, oh, there's voice, and so I know that I need to allocate, you know, this particular queue capacity, you know, and I need to, you know, deploy these particular priorities for this application and so forth without, you know, an engineer needing to sit down and design something that's also probably not going to fit voice traffic for more than a few weeks. You know, it's as that application changes and grows and, and that sort of thing. You know, and you know, which becomes part of it too, is for any application, you know, because they're going to have different demands. You know, they're going to grow or reduce, you know, as you maybe, you know, in a large network, you deploy more branch offices. And so now your network has to be able to support whatever applications are being sourced out of that branch office. You know, but these applications might also be changing hourly in the network, you know,
I designed for the target, then you move the target. Stop doing that.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, so what happens if you have a network that's intelligent enough to be able to adapt, you know, hourly or minute by minute, maybe to allocate and release resources for, you know, depending on what the application is demanding.
There's been some of that in the security space.
I mean, yeah, yeah. Yeah,
you know, observe what's going across the wire, and then, oh, this, you know, based on the analytical heuristics, I see an anomaly. I'm going to reprogram a limited set of flows to go after that anomaly and redirect that traffic to a quarantine VLAN or a honeypot or, you know, whatever it is. But it's from a capacity planning perspective, the only thing I've ever seen come out is just some of these apps that will deal with voice because it talks to you know, Microsoft, well, I don't call it Link anymore, Skype for Business server, and then can do some QoS plumbing for end-to-end yep. to preserve that voice. But it's never been it's always been vendor-specific. It's always required specific hardware, and it's never been the kind of thing that could easily be deployed across any sort of an infrastructure because of all of the specifics that are required to make something like that happen. If that's just one example, I mean, I don't know how... It's unimaginably hard, I think, maybe, to make that work, even though it would be ideal.
This comes back to the orchestrators again, Ethan. Like, you look at what we saw with Riverbed and SD-WAN, or what Big Switch is doing with their product, or what NSX is doing with flow management and the virtual switch. So in NSX, at the virtual switch, they can detect those flows. And those solutions all scale because they're not trying to do it in the switch. They're not trying to do it in the underlay. They're doing it right at the very edge of the network. So where NSX gets its scalability is every time the server gets bigger and the Intel CPU gets faster and more functions, NSX gets more performance and more features. And if you use smart NICs, the NSX performance can leap right through the roof, literally, if you can get into and the VMware NSX BU is, you know, I hear little rumors that they're working on, you know, hardware support for NICs that can actually offload all of the networking functions directly into a dedicated processor, you know, like a Mellanox or a Netronome or one of those companies. I think once you've got those functions at the edge of the network, it becomes a problem of how do you program it? What does the software look like that says, scan the packet, look for this pattern match, and then do this flow management to it? And how does that work? And that's the thing we haven't seen yet is... Well, we're only just starting to see what NSX and what Big Switch are doing, you know, and all the other SDN vendors too, by the way. So, but by and large, is they're all actually starting to get into the virtual switch at the edge because what happens in the physical network doesn't matter. And the reason, there are lots of reasons why the physical network doesn't matter in the long term. In the short term, the physical network matters because you've got all these legacy assets. But my view is always whatever the legacy is, that's one network over there. That's where your legacy exists. You have a new network over here where your overlay stuff sits. Because your next generation of IT, some of it is going to be in-house and some of it's going to be in the public cloud. And there's nothing you can do about that. That's just going to be the way it is. And you're going to have to connect VMs in the private cloud to VMs in the public cloud. And that's going to be all software. You'll have no hardware control. And the very idea that you're going to have your network functions coordinated in hardware and in someone's software in the public cloud and someone's software in the private cloud, just that's just too hard. Just do it all in one place, right? It's going to be virtual from end to end, because why would you add yourself the complexity of trying to orchestrate your legacy infrastructure? Just leave it alone. Let it rot and die. Treat it like a compost pile, right? That's where the old stuff goes, and it just composts down until it disappears, and eventually there's a smelly pile of wet grass that you've been ignoring for 5 years, and you think maybe I should burn it.
Yeah, if you got it, you got to jump in here. But Greg, let me disagree violently that that your packet movers
just bring it, interesting. Bring it on.
They aren't interesting, but they do matter. You're trying to make it say that they make it sound like they don't matter. So there, I'll let Jeff go from there.
Well, you know, I mean. What Greg was saying really kind of pulls me back in from you know, I was starting to speculate kind of wildly there around, you know, having a network that's intelligent enough to adapt itself to applications, when what we've been talking about all along and sort of where the trend is going is, in fact, you know, with NFV and SDN and all of this, is we no longer want intelligence down at the network, you know, at the forwarding plane. We just want big dumb boxes that do what they're told. You know, and so, you know, I guess I should caveat some of my speculation with, you know, with, yeah, that's going to need to be at an orchestration layer rather than in the network or in the forwarding plane.
Well, I think this is temporary to some extent. I do think that right now, hardware capabilities have accelerated past our ability to consume them. So that for the last 30 years, we've never had enough bandwidth or enough TCAMs or enough forwarding performance or enough buffers or enough, you know, whatever it is, there's always been something that was limited. And I was talking with a customer the other day, and he said, you know what I did? I said, we were talking about his internet and had traffic shaping on the internet. He said, you know what I did? I rang up my provider and said, what are my options for upgrade? They said, oh, you've got a 20 meg internet connection. We can upgrade that to 100 meg now for free. Right. And all he had to do was ring up and ask. Right. And so all of a sudden his quality of service problems literally just poof. His internet connection is now 5 times faster for no cost and no change. The weakness here is that if we go from 1 gig to servers to 10 gig to servers, we have this the current infrastructure, the way it currently operates with bare metal and or even most of the VMs, the idea of using vSphere, just a simple vSphere installation to run VMs, is you can't actually upgrade from 1 to 10 easily. Things have to be shut off or shut down, or storage arrays need to be effectively replaced to go from 1 gig to 10 gig of all things, because apparently the NICs that go into storage arrays aren't actually the same as everybody else's. They have special unicorn tiers, you know, inside them to just make you weep as you pay for those things at ridiculous prices, right? There's no, so, you know, we've got this architecture, this infrastructure which resists change. So to me, having the virtualized overlays and this idea of virtualized functions and just saying, you know, instead of paying $25,000 for software that goes onto a mainframe, why don't I just go and buy Microsoft Word for $1,500? I mean, why is it that a BGP protocol costs more than Microsoft Word? It's not, Microsoft Word is far more complicated than a BGP routing stack. And yet people quite literally pay $25,000 per license for one of those and pay a maintenance fee in the order of $5,000 to $10,000 per device per year to get a program that's roughly the same as Microsoft Notepad in complexity.
Because it's mysterious and nobody knows how to do it.
Well, and now we have companies like and now we have companies like and you know what? And now we have companies like SnapRoute, who wrote one, open sourced it, and is now being used by some of the biggest MSDCs in the world, and it's better. Yep. And they're going like, no, BGP, and it's free. You can go and get it from GitHub.
You know, that's where there is a risk for the legacy vendors, you know, the Ciscos and Junipers and such out there, of, you know, they've got to adapt or die, because more and more people are starting to see that, you know, I'm not any longer going to buy, you know, pay this huge premium for the software with every single box that I buy and be paying a premium for features I'm not ever going to use. Mm-hmm. So there becomes a market for, I can sell you, or you, maybe you go out and buy, your bare metal box, and then I'll sell you a network operating system that has just the features you need, at a reasonable price, without all this extraneous stuff.
Yeah, but changing people's minds, reminding people that, getting people to realize the transition is actually going to be quite difficult. And I don't know how we actually say to people, look, the stuff that you've been complaining about, all the things that you want, it's not like the big vendors that you've been dealing with for 30 years actually have a specific skill or a talent. They're the only people who can write this software. So it's going to take time for that change to run through the industry. I think it's not going to happen overnight.
Yeah, I agree.
This idea of going and buying and getting a BGP protocol for free but comes without support for most companies is going to be just, that's not going to fly. But the reality is it could fly because we know people who are using it.
Oh, yeah. At what point do people discover that a BGP implementation at some point is a pretty, like you were saying, is a pretty simple thing. And, if you don't intentionally make it complex, then it's not going to be necessarily buggy and it may work.
Yeah. What made it hard was just not many people used it. It wasn't it wasn't ubiquitous. It wasn't widely known or adopted or consumed. And so resources and like any good capitalist market, there was just not a lot of demand to simplify it and streamline it and make it less problematic. But networking has grown, I think, and this is where NFV comes in. NFV will create more networking than ever before, I feel, because we can have more functions at a lower cost per unit. So now we can actually build networks that are far more complex than we've ever done before with many, many more functions. We're not going to be stuck with one big firewall at the edge of the data center. We're going to be able to have data centers all over the place, if that makes sense.
Yeah, but it's interesting bringing that up, maybe trying to get back around to NFV a little bit in the data center, at least. That was sort of one of the early drivers around virtualized network functions in the data center. And, everybody talks about this in the context of SDN. And everybody's heard this spiel of, it used to be that 80% of traffic going in and out of the data or traffic on the data center was north and south, in and out of the data center, whereas 80% now is east west across the data center. And so it's no longer practical to stick all your firewalls, right at the entry point to your data center. You may need to have distributed firewalls throughout your data center horizontally. And, which becomes, if you're buying appliances, that becomes very expensive and really financially prohibitive.
Well, there's also one more thing, too, is that you're now seeing the edge of the network. So, for example, if you're putting firewalls to protect yourself from the public access internet, you're now looking at 10 gig as being the minimum level of connectivity, maybe getting up towards 100 gig if you need to resist. You're not going to be able to resist a distributed denial of service, but a targeted denial of service, which DDoS scrubbers can't handle. You may need to have 100 gigs of performance of network connection, or even at 110 or whatever the numbers are. You're not going to do that with the idea of one big firewall. You're going to have a way of scaling horizontally to even just scale up the front end. Or if you want to start adding more firewalls in your data center, and all of what you're trying to firewall is virtual appliances, you can't have a physical firewall and then try and run a virtual network into a physical firewall, because physical firewalls are secure. The operating systems inside of those things can't have their networking kernel violated by external networking code, right? How are you going to configure a firewall? It has to be virtual. There's all these problems that just loop into that discussion.
Absolutely.
But, I think, how we've got a lot into the business side, but not a lot on the answers. Is it fair to say that NFV is still emergent? Like, if you look at what you search up on some of the links, I've been looking in the NFV Mano working group, where they talk about these architectural frameworks and defining use cases and requirements. they don't seem to be very far down the standards definition process either.
Yeah, that's true. I think that you know, there are some careful NFV deployments out there. Interestingly, I read this somewhere and I can't remember where the source was, so I can't cite it. But right now, about 70% of VNFs that are being deployed or at least being experimented with are around mobile networks. You know, there's a lot of interest there. But in general, even though network operators or, you know, or service provider and telco operators are saying, you know, well, we by this date intend to have, you know, this certain percentage of our network be NFV capable. Everybody's, for the most part, is carefully experimenting with it right now. And, you know, there's a lot of sharing of early lessons learned still in deployments right now. So, you know, you mentioned earlier, gosh, I can't even remember now what it was you were referring to about still being down in the trough of disillusionment. I think even SDN is really just starting to climb out of that and be practical. NFV is still sort of dropping into that trough, and it's not there yet.
Yeah, I mean, you know, IDC published some results this week, and there's a $2.4 trillion spend in IT, enterprise IT. So, you know, an SDN market that's valued at sub $10 billion is like amateur hour, you know, not even a drop in the virtual bucket.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is, again, one of these emerging things. Like, I'm sort of reminded back in like the late 90s when it was becoming clear that IPX was never going to scale very much and we were all going to transition to TCP/IP, but it wasn't, you know, the last of the vendors like Banyan Vines was making a play for its protocol. And, you know, there was a whole bunch of other protocols around that were all saying, no, we're going to be the future as well. But the only reason they had traction was because they had existing customers using those protocols scaled to what was then a global network. And eventually, you know, TCP/IP won because it had no cost associated with it. The standards were clearly well-defined. It had been around for a very long period of time, but it was very hard to use and very hard. And it took many years for vendors like Microsoft to write a decent TCP/IP stack in their operating system, and Linux for that matter. Not so much Linux, actually, that's not true. But, you know, to get adoption going took a long time. So I don't think you should reasonably expect NFV to arrive, 2 years? Is it going to be 5 years, 2 years? What do you think, Jeff?
I think 5 years. I mean, you know, if we're talking about, you know, widespread common deployment in service provider networks or in service provider networks, probably longer as we've sort of been talking with enterprise. You know, NFV is already here to a large extent in data centers. We just don't tend to call it NFV.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about you, Ethan? Think we're going to see a rapid adoption of it? I mean, we have seen a form of network functions actually take off called software-defined WAN. And that stuff seems to be, you know, flying off the shelves. That's like the new hotness.
Ease of use is going to drive a lot of this, I think, in my opinion. And this goes back to a point you made earlier, Jeff, about expertise in certain organizations needing to be there. And so if it's got something that's easy to use, then great. So I think we're going to see some of this take the form of hyperconvergence, where the functions are going to be subsumed by the hyperconverged stack. And again, it goes back to that ease of use. It depends on who you're talking about, right? Who the consumer is, who the customer is, where it's going to take off. The service providers have that business reason to be using it. So obviously it's big there, oh boy, and it's not going away. And Onos is all about that. I keep reading the press releases coming out from those guys and what they're doing and how they're advancing things. And Cord is all about that, being able to push NFV into a Lego brick style central office. That's it. So those guys have got it. Other markets, man, I don't know. When you talk to people and hear that they're, again, going back to a conversation I had earlier today, the poor guy's still configuring not just routers and switches and load balancers one at a time at the CLI, also access points. He's not even in a shop that's forward enough to have used lightweight access points with a centralized controller. So I mean, again, it really is going to depend so heavily on the business and whether or not they can get their brains wrapped around it. And talking to sales teams, a lot of the salespeople seem to have no idea what these products are and what they're selling and what they can do. The training just isn't there. And so they're pushing what they know, which is the bigger version of what they sold last year. And so it's, you know, trying to predict the adoption timeline is bloody impossible. You can't call it. Does it make sense? And are we going to get there eventually? Yeah, but man, I don't, eventually has got a really elastic definition depending on who I'm talking to on any given day and how bullish I'm feeling.
Yeah. And, you know, and I think what you said early on, I mean, you know, ease of use and, you know, certainly is there a large business case in terms of, is it going to save me significant money? And, you know, once money's involved, you know, then salespeople very quickly are going to learn how to talk intelligently about the solutions. You know, vendors are very quickly going to start rolling out stuff that that actually makes sense. And, you know, and SD-WAN is the perfect example. You know, not only is it easy to use, you know, but there's a distinct case for saving money. And I've heard it on other packet pusher podcasts being talked about, you know, that sort of an early peripheral benefit of SD-WAN was people starting to realize that, you know, if we just have the analytics in our SD-WAN solution, looking at our very expensive MPLS network and looking at public internet, a lot of times it's switching all of what we thought we were wanting to protect on the MPLS network, like VoIP, onto the public internet because it's finding better performance there. And, you know, all of a sudden, you know, that solution is justifying its existence for more than what it was originally deployed to do.
I do wonder if we get to the point, like today, all of the SD-WAN vendors are producing completely proprietary closed systems. And that does worry me, but on the other hand, there's so much money to be made out of just getting something, you know, getting this working, that it's hard to say to people, you know, just wait, you know, don't worry about saving $10 million over 5 years. Just, you know, that doesn't work, right? But there is likely to be a situation where we're going to need to get SD-WAN vendors to interoperate together. And some of the standards that Etsy and Mano are putting together are actually, you know, they do provide a framework for communication between systems that do this, which is, although this is SD-WAN is much more SDN centric, but they're all building their edge appliances to have functions. So firewalls, they're getting load balancers to come onto those platforms. They're working with proxy vendors and cloud security companies to put cloud security scanning in the SD-WAN appliances at the edge of the network. So instead of just having a dumb router there, you know, you're replacing that path functionality, and then you're saying, well, if I've got an x86 server there, why don't I drop another 10 VMs in there and let them do a whole bunch of other stuff too? That's possibly a way that we could see NFV standards driven by vendors. Is that viable?
Yeah, it is. I mean, that's actually something you'll see listed as a speculative use case for NFV for service providers right now, or is virtualized CPE. You know, where you know, instead of having all these things, you know, on a customer site, at the service provider side of that, you know, we'll just deploy whatever, you know, firewalling and whatever other services we need on the service provider edge where that branch office or that customer is connecting.
I mean, it could come anywhere else. It could be the telcos that actually define this, because they're going to need to have, you know, millions of NFV instances. And so, you know, interoperability is going to be much more critical to them. And they want to be able to buy whoever's load balancer, whoever's fire. And they're driving towards this too. They're not just saying internally in their own meetings, this is what we want. They're actually in public, you know, AT&T talking about its domain 2.0, and Verizon's got its version of it. And the European telcos are out there at conferences saying, no, no, we're not going to take your proprietary APIs, Cisco, Ericsson, Nokia, you know, ZTE, Huawei, Checkpoint, whatever it is. We want open, well-defined, easily consumed, and you know, you need to be working with us to define stuff that we want. So I do believe that actually telcos are much more likely to drive NFV forward from the information I'm seeing than enterprises.
I entirely agree. And I think we kind of, you know, we began our whole conversation with that. that you know, the telcos and service providers are who's really driving this. And, you know, specifically, you were talking about SD-WAN. You know, I mean, that is such a new industry that's just really taken off. And, you know, there's what, 20-something different SD-WAN vendors out there right now. And like you said, you know, mostly proprietary solutions. It makes sense for service providers and telcos to start, you know, developing their own solutions around that, and, you know, instead of having a proprietary vendor go in and serve all of these this enterprise's, you know, hundreds of different branch offices or retail stores or whatever. Why not have the service provider do that?
Yeah, I just think about all the things that you can do. I mean, some of the other things that they're talking about doing in functions isn't just the traditional things like firewalls and proxy servers. It's also radius engines and 3G functions and like actual accounting stuff. So instead of having just one big database back in head office, move as much of that as possible out to the edge of the network too. Once you've got that flexibility about it, it's not just networking functions that you start to put into these platforms. It's actually apps. And I think that, anyway, I think we're starting to repeat ourselves, so we should probably hit the wrap right about here. Jeff, why don't you tell people on the internet where they can find you on the internet?
I am. You can search for me on LinkedIn, on Twitter. My email address is just jeff@doyleassociates.net. It's probably the best way to connect with me. I'm still maybe I'm an old fashioned guy, but I still read my email a lot more than I tend to read social media. I'm on Facebook. I'm on all of those places.
Fantastic. You'll find a bunch of links in the show notes to Jeff's books if you want to find out more. There are some good ones. The OSPF and ISIS was one I used, have used a couple of different times over the years on arguing with people, designing, working in a team play about whether we should be using OSPF or ISIS. It's a very good one on large-scale networks design. Yep,
that's actually my favorite book that I've. It's not the most popular book, but that's my favorite book that I've ever done.
And you really went out there on that one. It was literally the one that you got to say if you're thinking about large scale routing design, which is what you've really done a lot. That is the book where you sort of got to say what you wanted to say, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I've sort of been debating doing a second edition of that book, by the way.
Maybe with less ISIS, maybe. It's losing momentum. Mr. Banks, any closing thoughts?
Man, we've been recording for about 100 minutes now. How much of this makes the cut, we'll see. But the biggest takeaway for me is the fracturing of the industry, how we're seeing networking spread out even further as all of these new products have come to the fore and different people try to figure out what the heck they're supposed to do with them. So still a really interesting time to be in networking.
It is, and a lot of good opportunities for new businesses, too.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. It's a hell of a time to be in networking, that's for sure. There's going to be more of it, not less, but there will be different things to do, not the same as it's always been, and I think that's probably the thing that the podcast on NFE has been about. Now, as always, you can find this and many more fine-free technical podcasts along with our community blog at packetpushers.net. Follow the Packet Pushers on the Twitter with @packetpushers. You can find us on LinkedIn. We have a company page on Facebook, which is the best place to follow us because of the way Facebook works. Don't follow us personally because there's limits and there's things you don't get to see the posts because Facebook just wants you to pay to get to you. And of course, if you can follow us on iTunes and you use iTunes, it'd be really great if you could give us a rating. That helps people find us. If you have found something great about this podcast and you want to tell people about what Jeff's been talking about, please tell your friends about us. It's the best way for us to get a few more listeners and to get people engaged with us, which helps us to keep bringing you these podcasts. And as always, remember that too much technology would never be enough.